Manhello, and bon année. Happy 2020. So it looks like we'll finish the chapter tonight. Equality and the Annihilation of Ego, Chapter 9, in the Yoga Divine Works. We pick it up with this. Before this labor for the annihilation of desire and the conquest of the soul's equality can come to its absolute perfection and fruition, that turn of the spiritual movement must have been completed, which leads to the abolition of the sense of ego. But for the worker, the renunciation of the egoism of action is the most important element in this change. For even when, by giving up the fruits and the desire of the fruits to the master of the sacrifice, we have parted with the egoism of rajasic desire, we may still have kept the egoism of the worker. Still, we are subject to the sense that we are ourselves the doer of the act, ourselves its source, and ourselves the giver of the sanction. It is still the I that chooses and determines. It is still the I that undertakes the responsibility and feels the demerit or the merit. So this goes back to chapter 2 and 3 in the Bhagavad Gita. This idea of being able to get beyond egoism by offering the fruit of the work gets rid of the worst part of the ego, but doesn't eliminate it altogether. So it is a phased removal of the ego that the Gita even suggests. Refer to the second chapter, 47th shloka. What Sri Aurobindo wrote in the mother, in the fifth chapter, we'll call it, we'll get to shortly, but obviously that is a recognized chord running through this paragraph as well. An entire removal of this separative ego sense is an essential aim of our yoga. If any ego is to remain in us for a while, it is only a form of it which knows itself to be a form and is ready to disappear as soon as a true center of consciousness is manifested or built in us. So this would be a sublimely agreeable ego, wouldn't it, to be willing to disappear as soon as the soul comes in and blows its felicitous winds its way. Most egos are not so willing to depart. That true center is a luminous formulation of the one consciousness and a pure channel and instrument of the one existence. This goes back to that second chapter again, shloka 51, shloka 71. A support for the individual manifestation and action of the universal force, it gradually reveals behind it the true person in us, the central eternal being, an everlasting being of the supreme in a power and portion of the transcendent Shakti, Jiva Bhutam, the Supreme that becomes the Jiva, Gita, chapter 7, verse 5. I think this would be a good point at which to read the actual fifth chapter of the Mother, because it is precisely what he's speaking about here. And you remember letters 3, 4, and 5, chapters 3, 4, and 5, rather, were letters written to Poonam Chand Shah, who was living in Gujarat at this time, this would have been the fifth, would have been a letter written to him on the 19th of August, 1927, so shortly after Sri Aurobindo's birthday, about work and how to undertake it. And so here it is, the letter of Sri Aurobindo. If you want to be a true doer of divine works, your first aim must be to be totally free from all desire and self-regarding ego. All your life must be an offering and a sacrifice to the Supreme. Your only object in action shall be to serve, to receive, to fulfill, to become a manifesting instrument of the divine Shakti in her works. You must grow in the divine consciousness till there is no difference between your will and hers, no motive except her impulsion in you, no action that is not her conscious action in you and through you. Until you are capable of this complete dynamic identification, you have to regard yourself as a soul and body created for her service, one who does all for her sake. Even if the idea of the separate worker is strong in you, and you feel that it is you who do the act, yet it must be done for her. All stress of egoistic choice, all hankering after personal profit, all stipulation of self-regarding desire must be extirpated from the nature. There must be no demand for fruit and no seeking for reward. The only fruit for you is the pleasure of the Divine Mother and the fulfillment of her work. Your only reward, a constant progression in divine consciousness and calm and strength and bliss. The joy of service and the joy of inner growth through works is the sufficient recompense of the selfless worker. But a time will come when you will feel more and more that you are the instrument and not the worker. For first, by the force of your devotion, your contact with the Divine Mother will become so intimate that at all times you will have only to concentrate and to put everything into her hands to have her present guidance, her direct command or impulse, the sure indication of the thing to be done and the way to do it and the result. And afterwards, you will realize that the divine Shakti not only inspires and guides, but initiates and carries out your works. All your movements are originated by her. All your powers are hers. Mind, life, and body are conscious and joyful instruments of her action, means for her play, molds for her manifestation in the physical universe. There can be no more happy condition than this union and dependence. For this step carries you back beyond the borderline from the life of stress and suffering in the ignorance into the truth of your spiritual being, into its deep peace and its intense ananda. While this transformation is being done, it is more than ever necessary to keep yourself free from all taint of the perversions of the ego. Let no demand or insistence creep in to stain the purity or the self-giving and the sacrifice. There must be no attachment to the work or the result, no laying down of conditions, no claim to possess the power that should possess you, no pride of the instrument, no vanity or arrogance. Nothing in the mind or in the vital or physical parts should be suffered to distort to its own use or seize for its own personal and separate satisfaction the greatness of the forces that are acting through you. Let your faith, your sincerity, your purity of aspiration be absolute and pervasive of all the planes and layers of the being. Then every disturbing element and distorting influence will progressively fall away from your nature. The last stage of this perfection will come when you are completely identified with the Divine Mother and feel yourself to be no longer another and separate being, instrument, servant, or worker, but truly a child and eternal portion of her consciousness and force. Always she will be in you and you in her. It will be your constant, simple, and natural experience that all your thought and seeing and action, your very breathing or moving, come from her and are hers. You will know and see and feel that you are a person and power formed by her out of herself, put out from her for the play, and yet always safe in her. Being of her being, consciousness of her consciousness, force of her force, ananda of her ananda. When this condition is entire, and her supramental energies can freely move you, then you will be perfect in divine works. Knowledge, will, action will become sure, simple, luminous, spontaneous, flawless, an outflow from the Supreme, a divine movement of the Eternal. It rather captures everything in the span of a couple of pages that we've been discussing for a month. So we continue with the synthesis. But before we do that, before we go to the next paragraph, he touches here upon the true person in us, this Jivabhutam, manifested from the higher nature, as the Gita says, Pra-Prakriti. This eternal individual radiation of that Supreme Sun is what stands at the center of all of our being. And there's a footnote here at the bottom, Amsha Sanatana. In other words, the eternal portion, the portion eternal, and Para Prakritir Jiva Bhuta, the Supreme Nature who manifests this, the Supreme that becomes the Jiva. There is no separation. The Supreme is invested in the individual, in the eternity of the individual soul. This is not the ego. This is not the perishable person. This is the eternal person inside, who in a sense brings that transcendence into the cosmic dimension to stand as the growing individual, supports that. So that's the Gita 15:7, and again the Gita 7:5. Here too, in this movement by which the soul divests itself gradually of the obscure robe of the ego, there is a progress by marked stages. For not only the fruit of works belongs to the Lord alone, but our works also must be His. Again, Gita 4:24. He is the true Lord of our actions, no less than of our results. This we must not see with the thinking mind only. It must become entirely true to our entire consciousness and will. The sadhaka has not only to think and know, but to see and feel concretely and intensely, even in the moment of the working and in its initiation and whole process, that his works are not his at all, but are coming through him from the supreme existence. He must be always aware of a force, a presence, a will that acts through his individual nature. But there is, in taking this turn, the danger that he may confuse his own disguised or sublimated ego or an inferior power with the Lord and substitute its demands for the supreme dictates. He may fall into a common ambush of this lower nature and distort his supposed surrender to a higher power into an excuse for a magnified and uncontrolled indulgence of his own self-will and even of his desires and passions. A great sincerity is asked for and has to be imposed not only on the conscious mind, but still more on the subliminal part of us, which is full of hidden movements. For there is there, especially in our subliminal vital nature, an incorrigible charlatan and actor. And I think here we should note that this language in which he's composing this is prior to a decade hence, when he's basically writing The Life Divine. I think we might be able to presume that this is a remnant of the 1932 revision before he had crystallized his approach to what is the interior nature of cosmos and personal being, in which there was the superficial being, the subliminal mind, life, body behind, including the sukshma sharira, and then behind that, the conscious soul supporting all these instruments of the nature. So when he's regarding the subliminal vital who's an incorrigible charlatan, this is not the true subliminal vital of the life divine, which is responsible for the beauty and dream visions, etc., that come flooding out from behind when the artist awakens to its presence. This subliminal vital is a different character. The sadhaka must first have advanced far in the elimination of desire and in the firm equality of his soul towards all workings and all happenings before he can utterly lay down the burden of his works on the divine. At every moment, he must proceed with a vigilant eye upon the deceits of the ego and the ambushes of the misleading powers of darkness, whoever represent themselves as the one source of light and truth, and take on them a simulacrum of divine forms in order to capture the soul of the seeker. So those wily asuras and rakshasas are always trying to lead us astray into various allurements, and the awakening soul has to step carefully around them and avoid all those entrapments. Immediately, he must take the further step of relegating himself to the position of the witness. And here we're back to the Sankhya system and its terminology. The witness is the sakshi in Sankhya philosophy. Aloof from the prakriti, nature, impersonal and dispassionate, he must watch the executive nature force at work within him and understand its action. He must learn by this separation to recognize the play of her universal forces, distinguish her interweaving of light and night, the divine and the undivine, and detect her formidable powers and beings that use the ignorant human creature. So, Sri Aurobindo expects that the sakshi, that the witness, will observe intently the action of the nature through all of these contours of natural being and be able to stand back and regard itself as a witness of that, not confusing the two, not becoming enmeshed in those actions. Nature works in us, says the Gita, through the triple quality of prakriti, the quality of light and good, sattva, the quality of passion and desire, rajas, and the quality of obscurity and inertia, tamas. The seeker must learn to distinguish as an impartial and discerning witness of all that proceeds within this kingdom of his nature, the separate and the combined action of these qualities. He must pursue the workings of the cosmic forces in him through all the labyrinth of their subtle unseen processes and disguises and know every intricacy of the maze. So this is a focused observance of the witness power. It is not simply a sheer witness standing free and aloof, watching impersonally, but is studying, is intensely observing, is understanding how all of this works. This is, in a sense, precedent to the Sakshi becoming the willful observer and inserting a spiritual influence upon nature. First, the detached consciousness studies, analyzes, and becomes a knower of the field. Later, it becomes the master of the field. As he proceeds in this knowledge, he will be able to become the giver of the sanction, anumantra, and no longer remain an ignorant tool of nature. At first, he must induce the nature force in its action on his instruments to subdue the working of its two lower qualities and bring them into subjection to the quality of light and good. And afterwards, he must persuade that again to offer itself so that all three may be transformed by a higher power into their divine equivalents, supreme repose and calm, divine illumination and bliss, the eternal divine dynamis, tapas. In other words, he's saying that we must sattva-size prakriti is the first step, and then implies that a descent is necessary from above to change tamas into shama, inertia into calm and peace, to change sattva into jyoti. Instead of mere equilibrium and balance, turn it into light, and to establish these divine contraries throughout the whole nature. Tapas will replace rajas. So all the three elements that we think comprise normal nature and we want to stand back from it because it enmeshes us in ignorance are all extensions of a supreme power, who are small corollaries of what those greater forces and lights are above. What we want to do is to trigger the descent of those by becoming aware of them. First, we have to know this nature, then we have to become aware of that and trigger the descent into the lower. The first part of this discipline and change can be firmly done in principle by the will of the mental being in us. In other words, we can create a sort of mentalized way station which will act as a a step upward on the ladder to get to that. But its full execution and the subsequent transformation can be done only when the deeper psychic soul increases its hold on the nature and replaces the mental being as its ruler. You remember the Upanishad, which refers to the mind as being leader of the mind, life, and body, of the whole constituted nature that we possess. Sri Aurobindo insists on the further step. Mind is not sufficient to lead. Soul has to come forward and lead all the instrumental nature. When this happens, he will be ready to make, not only with an aspiration and intention and an initial and progressive self-abandonment, but with the most intense actuality of dynamic self-giving, the complete renunciation of his works to the supreme will. So it's not a resignation that Sri Aurobindo is looking for here, but an active offering. By degrees, his mind of an imperfect human intelligence will be replaced by a spiritual and illumined mind. And that can, in the end, enter into the supramental truth light. He will then no longer act from his nature of the ignorance with its three modes of confused and imperfect activity, but from a diviner nature of spiritual calm, light, power, and bliss. So it's a phased progress. First, we establish a sattva-sized, mentalized existence. Then we step into an overhead consciousness governed by light, and that leads us to the further ascent into the supramental consciousness. He will act not from an amalgam of an ignorant mind and will with the drive of a still more ignorant heart of emotion and the desire of the life being and the urge and instinct of the flesh, but first from a spiritualized self and nature, and last from a supramental truth consciousness and its divine force of supernature. So from a sattva-sized life of the mind, we step into a spiritualized awareness of the one around and live from that and rise from that into the supramental. Thus are made possible the final steps, when the veil of nature is withdrawn and the seeker is face to face with the master of all existence and his activities are merged in the action of a supreme energy which is pure, true, perfect, and blissful forever. So this is that station in which Ishvara and Shakti become one and known to the rising consciousness of the soul. Thus can he utterly renounce to the supramental Shakti his works as well as the fruits of his works, and act only as the conscious instrument of the eternal worker. This takes us back to the chapter from the mother that we read a few minutes ago. No longer giving the sanction, he will rather receive in his instruments and follow in her hands a divine mandate. No longer doing works, he will accept their execution through him by her unsleeping force. No longer willing the fulfillment of his own mental constructions and the satisfaction of his own emotional desires, he will obey and participate in an omnipotent will that is also an omniscient knowledge and a mysterious, magical, and unfathomable love and a vast bottomless sea of the eternal bliss of existence. So this is the conversion of the higher nature, revealing the action in the supramental consciousness of the oneness of Satchit Ananda. next week we begin chapter 10, the three modes of nature, and go more deeply into the philosophy of Sankhya as applied to the transformation of life. So, this is a passage that we're drawing from Book 1 in Savitri, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 3, the Yoga of the Soul's Release, that we might have read last week to you, but this week I think it finds its same sure relevance. Already in him was seen that task of power. Life made its home on the high tops of self. His soul, mind, heart became a single sun. Only life's lower reaches remained dim. But there too, in the uncertain shadow of life, there was a labor and a fiery breath. The ambiguous cowled celestial puissance worked, watched by the inner witness's moveless peace. Even on the struggling nature left below, strong periods of illumination came. Lightnings of glory after glory burned. Experience was a tale of blaze and fire. Air rippled round the argosies of the gods. Strange riches sailed to him from the unseen. Splendors of insight filled the blank of thought. Knowledge spoke to the inconscient stillnesses. Rivers poured down of bliss and luminous force. Visits of beauty, storm sweeps of delight, rained from the all-powerful mystery above. Thence stooped the eagles of omniscience. A dense veil was rent, a mighty whisper heard. Repeated in the privacy of his soul, a wisdom cry from rapt transcendences sang on the mountains of an unseen world. The voices that an inner listening hears conveyed to him their prophet utterances, and flame-wrapped outbursts of the immortal word and flashes of an occult revealing light approached him from the unreachable secrecy. An inspired knowledge sat enthroned within, whose seconds illumined more than reason's years. An ictus of revealing luster fell, as if a pointing accent upon truth, and like a sky flare showing all the ground, a swift intuitive discernment shone. One glance could separate the true and false, or raise its rapid torch fire in the dark to check the claimants crowding through mind's gates, covered by the forged signatures of the gods, detect the magic bride in her disguise, or scan the apparent face of thought and life. Another section. His heights of being lived in the still self. His mind could rest on a supernal ground and look down on the magic and the play where the godchild lies on the lap of night and dawn, and the everlasting puts on time's disguise. To the still heights and to the troubled depths, his equal spirit gave its vast assent. a poised serenity of tranquil strength, a wide, unshaken look on time's unrest, faced all experience with unaltered peace. Indifferent to the sorrow and delight, untempted by the marvel and the call, immobile it beheld the flux of things, calm and apart, supported all that is. His spirit's stillness helped the toiling world. Inspired by silence and the closed eye's sight, his force could work with a new luminous art on the crude material from which all is made, and the refusal of inertia's mass, and the gray front of the world's ignorance, and nescient matter, and the huge error of life. As a sculptor chisels a deity out of stone, he slowly chipped off the dark envelope, line of defense of nature's ignorance, the illusion and mystery of the inconscient, in whose black pall the eternal wraps his head, that he may act unknown in cosmic time. A splendor of self-creation from the peaks, a transfiguration in the mystic depths, a happier cosmic working could begin and fashion the world shape in him anew. God found in nature, nature fulfilled in God. Again, Happy New Year. Our work continues. Much love. Jai Ma. Namaste.